Shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the next episode of We the People Radio. It is August 30th, 2026. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Kathy Kleinstaff.
She's been here so many times, she just introduces herself. Oh, my gosh. So we have done a zillion shows on marijuana, cannabis, whatever you want to call it, the THC thing, the epigenetics, like all these, the cartels. I mean, really.
Environmental, when it comes to marijuana, we've done everything.
Yeah. Typically, Officer Joe sits in with us, too, and the three of us actually went to Oregon to a law enforcement summit about this. So we spent a lot of time on that. And every time, we wind up talking about kratom. But we've never actually done a show about it. So, stumbled upon our new best friend, Dean Francis, who was all about kratom, and I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. Kathy is going to be so excited. So I'm really happy you were able to sit in with us. So, about our new best friend, Dean Francis, he founded End Kratom Addiction after his son Cameron spent nearly 8 years addicted to a substance he found online that was marketed as a safe herbal supplement. At which point, you know, it's hard to continue because we're all gagging. Dean founded End Kratom Addiction after Cameron's addiction and recovery. He testifies before state legislatures, briefs local officials, and works with medical and legal professionals to advance kratom regulation nationwide. Cameron, his son, was a college athlete. He wasn't reckless. He was just deceived. And when the family finally got answers in an emergency room in 2021, from a physician who explained plainly that kratom acts like an opioid, they were furious, not at Cameron, but at the industry that had marketed a dangerous product as harmless and a regulatory system that had allowed it. The site is endkratom, K-R-A-T-O-M, addiction.org. They also have things on YouTube, and the front of their webpage, I cut it and stuck it on our page for today. It's a kind of a ghosted picture of the front of a gas station where we've all been a million times. And then in big white print, it's called Gas Station Heroin. And Kathy was just nodding. Yep, that's what everyone calls it. So
7-0. Gas Station Heroin.
So, Dean, thank you for joining us on a Sunday afternoon, talking about apparently all
thank
of our favorite subjects.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Erin. That's a really excellent introduction, extremely accurate in terms of kind of what has occurred and led to this. So, but again, thanks for having me on.
Yep, we figured this was a hole, actually, in our information. And our site, I always give it to elected officials. We have a tab on our website that says POT. And it has photos, video, interviews. It's a research site, really, that we've been creating. So we're adding you to the research. And it's always helpful to have a voice because not everyone is a big reader. So they can listen if they want. And it's free. All our archives are free and have no interruptions. So anybody listening who's like, well, I don't want to sit through the whole thing, great, come back. Go to wethepeopleradio.us. Go to the top. Click POT. And you can find the interview later today. So where would you like to start with this?
Well, I'll lead him into it.
Sorry.
Yeah.
This is my friend Kathy.
So, okay. So when you found out that kratom was what brought your son to the emergency room, where did you go from that? How did you educate yourself?
Well, I wish, first and foremost, back when that happened, that dreadful night, someone would have sat us down and helped us really understand the gravity of opioid addiction. I still didn't fully understand. I recognized at that moment that his addiction was severe, that it had to do with kratom, and, of course, it was described as an opioid. But We don't have any substance use disorder in our family. I haven't known people that have been addicted here and there, maybe to alcohol. But I wish somebody would have looked us right in the eyes and said, if you don't understand what opioid addiction is, you need to quickly recognize we're talking about the equivalent of stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, and you better take it as serious as anything you've ever taken in your life. And here is the path that you've got to take. And any alteration from that, you will risk losing years of your life, which is what happened to Cameron, or worse. Unfortunately, for so many parents that have lost kids, spouses that have lost spouses. And so it was shocking, but it was also helpful to kind of know that, okay, here's the real issue. Because Cameron at that point had also begun drinking. I mean, and just want to put more context to your story. He was near a 4-minute mile in college, okay? Like, he is not just any, college athlete. He has poured himself into a sport over years, working his butt off to break the 4-minute mile and run an NCAA championship. And I remember being at the track meet. It was an indoor track meet in Boston, a huge track meet, by the way, for the East Coast at the time. And it was January 2017. And I remember watching him. He ran somewhere between, it was a medley relay, so he ran somewhere between 4:03 and 4:06 that day. And I remember thinking, this is unbelievable. He's going to do it his junior year. I just knew it. Like, that spring, this is going to go down, his dream. I was so excited for him. And but in retrospect, it was a few weeks before that, he had begun taking Kratom. And it was energizing him, like his workouts. Like, it was like he thought he found a miracle drug. Like, he was like, this is a plant-based herbal supplement. I work out better. I focus more on my studies. And if I go to a party where there's drinking, I don't drink. I just have my super healthy social tonic here. It makes you a little more chatty, but not high or anything. And he's like, this is just great. And by the spring, he was a wreck.
Did you know that he was doing that at the time, or did you only find out kind of after the fact?
We were aware somewhere along the way that he was shaking a green powder in his water bottle. Everybody knew, by the way. Everybody knew. There was no, you wouldn't hide it, right? I mean, it's a...
Well, it wasn't illegal or anything,
so... There's no reason.
Yeah.
No, and it wasn't like he was even going into a smoke shop, right? I mean, he just saw it online and like, oh, sounds good. And that's what happened. So there's no one, himself, us, his friends, everybody, yeah. No one is associating this decline in his life with the Kratom. And so, long story short, he drops out of school, he comes back home, he's depressed. I mean, we go to a counselor, we're getting Prozac. We have 5 kids, by the way. I mean, they're all thriving in so many ways, doing great. Cameron loves his family. He's got tons of friends, and he is literally a wreck. And now we're associating this with possible outside things. Like, he did get a new coach that year. The coach was an absolute jerk, like a Nazi Germany general, and just stole his love for the sport. I mean, that was not that good. They eventually fired him. And then the girl that he thought might be the one, they broke up. I mean, like, so there's some things like that. But, uh-huh. Like, really? This depressed? I mean, this bad? And then next thing you know, he turns to alcohol. And so that was kind of where he began to focus, and we began to focus, like, hey, you've got a drinking problem, and you've got to deal with it. And he would go to some AA meetings. He would do these things. Now, in retrospect, it all made sense. He was medicating the opioid withdrawal from Kratom. And you don't have to go far to find anybody that has been addicted to Kratom that will tell you the withdrawals are very, very similar to any other opioid. They're extraordinary. And so, I mean, he's honest about that. There's no, like, you understand that he's not rebelling. He's trying to figure this out. And, but that's what led to the emergency room visit, where we then learned what was actually happening and the real issue. So the question you asked was, what do we do? And I just, as quickly as possible, got on a call with a doctor. It was a telemedicine type call. And but he deals with addiction. And again, this is still kind of new. You have to keep in mind, I mean, Kratom doesn't really come into the scene until about 2016, 17. It's now kind of rolling a bit, but it's in the addiction treatment world, still pretty new. So the doctor says to him, and this would be my translation, basically, this is probably going to be the hardest thing you've ever done in your life, but you can do it. You're going to just need to wean off of this over like 60 days, you know, a long period of time. And whatever he said, I just, you know, Cameron, right? He's an athlete. Like, I'm going to do it faster. So I'm the dispenser, right? I've got then, so we use capsules so that we knew exactly how much he was getting. And the idea was just to slowly decline them. And without getting graphic, in time, I saw a level of withdrawal that I didn't know existed. I didn't understand it was awful what we saw and what we experienced. And it was just, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And so eventually I hit a point where I'm like, this isn't going to happen on his own. Like, I don't know, maybe we should have just done it over a longer period of time, but this was insane. Like, keep in mind, he had taken the stuff for about 3+ years by then. So I'm sure the longer you take it, the worse it makes. So I then Google, and I found him in Richmond, Virginia, where we are, a particular medical detox clinic that was advertising to help with kratom. And I'm like, whoa, this is what? I said, call right away. And the woman who answered the phone, so nice. And she just quickly said to me, look, first thing you need to know is we're treating so many people for kratom. You have absolutely no idea. There's nothing unique about your son. It's happening a lot. And she said, the second thing, though, you do need to understand, this is where I began to get a little more of the gravity. She said, it takes one day for us to detox somebody for alcohol. But for heroin, fentanyl, and kratom, it takes 5. And I'm like, she put it in the same category. Like, I don't know. I am still kind of blown away, but I'm still thinking that, okay, you do the 5-day detox and then it all works out, right? It gets better. Well, no. If you don't know anything about this kind of stuff, when you finish detox, you're now a chef because your body doesn't know how to produce dopamine and serotonin anymore. You have no motivation. Uh-huh. You don't even care to live. You're a disaster. Cameron would tell you that the next 5 or 6 months were probably the worst 5 or 6 months of his life. As bad as things have been at times, that was one of the worst. He was doing everything he could. I would take him to the gym each day, but he was a zombie. And it was, what I experienced there was just awful. So that's kind of, I guess, where we're starting.
Well, okay, so for those of us who had the great fortune of not knowing someone addicted to kratom, that or heroin or any of the things you listed. So, I mean, you see in movies and things, you know, alcohol, the alcohol addiction. So outside the addiction, just the getting off of these substances, like what happens to your system? Like, what's going on? Are you throwing up? Are you, I mean, is this the thing where you wind up having, you really should be in like some sort of a facility? Is it that kind of thing?
I don't want to dismiss the fact that there are those who have plugged into online recovery communities, specifically the Kratom. One of them is called Kratom Quitters. I think it's kratomquitters.com. So my executive director, her name is Hillary Tesluck. When End Kratom Addiction it took off fast, and next thing we know, we're helping other states, and now we're at a national level. But anyway, I brought her on in February, and she was one of the co-founders of Kratom Quitters. And it's an online kratom recovery community that literally grew to over 10,000 people, which was, this is, and about, as soon as I learned about it, I was like, that's probably, that was the kind of thing that Cameron was kind of missing, because if you go to an AA meeting, it sounds weird to the other people in the AA or the NA meeting that you got addicted to what? You got addicted to what is this? You know, like it just wasn't clicking. So anyway, there have been people, they usually will tell people to wean off over longer periods, like sometimes 60, 90 days, and then they tell you about all these supplements you can take, healthy supplements that will help you. But the main strength that you get is plugging into calls. Like, you can be on as many as 3 calls a day in that community. And so people will draw strength from that. So it is possible. Cameron would tell you, I don't know how you do it. So for a lot of people, yes, you're going to be better off if you have insurance or some resources to afford it to go to a medical detox, the one I just referred to with an outpatient one. So it can be done outpatient. But I would actually argue the best thing would be, if at all possible, you need to go to a residential community for at least 90 days. Like, I wouldn't mess around with it. I would have a solid minimum 12-month plan. So even when you come out of the 90-day, you're in kind of a step down where there's still a lot of accountability, and you gradually integrate back into your life. Because what happens is, your next 30 days, let's say you go through an outpatient detox, or you just weaned off, your next 30, 60 days, 90 days, you're still very vulnerable to the post-acute withdrawal. The post-acute withdrawal has a lot of anxiety to it and will drive people right back. And you'll think to yourself, I'll just need a little bit, just a little bit. And it's not like alcohol. You could go screw up as an alcoholic tonight, mess up, and get back on the horse tomorrow. When you talk about opioids, not so much. You retake something, you're pretty much zoom right back to the start line. And it's so there's not much mercy or grace to this. So, yes, for a lot of people, they'd be much better off if they can go that route.
So, hang on. We have to take a really quick break. Ponder that one. We have so many questions. I know we're going to run out of time. I can already feel it. So, just spoiler alert, we'll have to have you come on again. Our guest is Dean Francis. The website that we're referencing that has all the information is endkratomaddiction.org. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
They did a bad, bad thing. 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 You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two?
Since 1934, Grange Co-op has stood for more than just a store. It's all about neighbors helping neighbors, families growing together, and communities thriving. And now, that tradition is here in Reading. From feed and garden supplies to tools and pet essentials, Grange Co-op has what you need. With service you can trust. Visit us today at 55 Lake Boulevard. Grange Co-op, trusted by neighbors since 1934.
Explore, learn, and play this summer at Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Discover 300 acres of adventure featuring the Turtle Bay Museum, playgrounds, animals, botanical gardens, trails, and so much more. This summer, experience Popnology and explore science and technology. Marvel at hundreds of butterflies in our butterfly house. Feed lorikeets in Parrot Playhouse. Hop on a ride with the Turtle Express train. And don't miss the popular Walk on the Wild Side Animal Show. Plan your visit today at turtlebay.org.
Every drive tells a story. Morning commutes, weekend getaways, road trips that stretch for miles. That's why you need Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. At Quick and Clean Car Wash, you'll receive a detailed hand scrub pre-clean, a gentle soft cloth wash, and a personal towel dry brings out a smooth, polished shine. Fast, affordable, starting at only $12. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
For me, the best part of my day is when a commercial loan actually closes. The owner of the business, they finally have the cash to go do what they want to do to grow their business. They might have stressed about this, hoping it would all work, and when it all comes together as planned, it's a win-win for everyone. So I like that. I like it when people are happy, like, yes, I got my money, because it can be very stressful.
Plumas Bank. Experienced bankers. Real solutions. Visit plumasbank.com.
Yes, bad medicine indeed. So, Dean, there are all sorts of... I was just telling Kathy there was a physician who had phoned who thought legislation should be passed to exempt this, and it was 10 years ago or maybe a little longer, and he was just positive this was the answer to opioids and pain, and it's not an opioid, and it's natural and all this stuff, and... Okay, I'm not going to lie. I should have been more open-minded or not. But I was like, yeah, hard pass. I was pretty sure that sounded fake. And, imagine that. It was
fake. That's how it was sold. I mean, what you just said right there is how this thing really came to life, because they were kind of saying this is kind of a tool for all those that had been affected by the opioid crisis.
That's exactly what this guy was pushing.
Well, and that's why, like when you said, it's so hard to get off of it, because it's, you come out of an addiction clinic or whatever, and for opiates or heroin or whatever, the only way you can get that is go to your drug dealer, where kratom, you just go to a gas station. Like, literally,
it's terrifying.
It would be so easy to get right back into that.
Yes, I'm told if you've been addicted in the past to anything, when you take kratom, you're very vulnerable to getting addicted just almost immediately.
Dang.
By the way, you mentioned doctors too. And you're talking about the excruciating pain of the jaw. If anyone out there has not watched Dope Sick, I think it's on Hulu, that series is in part based on Dr. Stephen Lloyd. And so when you watch Michael Keaton, who's playing the role of a doctor who's prescribing Oxycontin more and more because he's being told by the Purdue Pharma sales rep, oh, it's fine, you know, keep going, lots of accessibility, make it easy to get, you know, all the kind of stuff. And the doctor gets addicted, and they show what he goes through. Well, I just interviewed Dr. Stephen Lloyd on my podcast, so a little shout-out for our new YouTube channel.
Yes, it's on our page, too. It's very good.
Thank you. Well, this will drop this Wednesday, 1 o'clock Eastern. And so I got to interview Dr. Stephen Lloyd. And he's like, Dean, it happened. Episode 3 to 7, what you see happen with Michael Keaton in Dope Sick, that was me. That was my story. They asked me. I gave them the details. It's horrifying. When you watch it, you're sitting there going, I can't believe it. And I think that's the point to opioid addiction, is I don't care who you are. I don't care if you've been addicted before or not addicted. You have lots of degrees, no degrees, doesn't matter. It is merciless. And it absolutely turns you into someone that you're not. And I ask him questions directly about that, and he kind of explains what's happening in the brain. And so this is why he is probably the most passionate on the subject of kratom of any physician I have spoken to. We have lots of partner physicians. They're all unbelievably awesome. But he lived it. And because of it, the idea that there's an industry who's profiting off of duping people into an opioid addiction, it is the most infuriating thing you can see in the call. He has to hold back. There's another level of language he uses off the podcast. But it is... I wish more lawmakers would watch that and fully understand when we say the word addiction, we're not talking about, I'm eating too many donuts. You just need to straighten up. You just need some more. I mean, like, you're talking about literally tearing apart someone's life, and it's not going to be over, like, next month. It is going, the road to recovery, I like to say it, you get on your hands and knees and climb Mount Everest, or if you're near Redding, Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
So what does kratom do to your body? What is it affecting to give it that opioid response?
So you all have heard, I'm sure, right? I heard one of you said 7-OH. You know, 7-OH has been what the, you know, everyone's been calling out now for the last 2 years. You know, going off the chart. Now the DEA is doing a scheduling for any product that goes above a certain amount of threshold of 7-OH. And that is true. That's all very true. 7-OH, definitely, it's kind of like heroin. You know, Cameron, it took probably a good 2 months, 3 months before he was building all the dependence. In other words, you know, the tolerance where you got to take more and more and more to get the same effect. And then eventually you're physiologically dependent on it, which is where you can talk about vomiting, throwing up, all that kind of stuff. And then when you reach a level of addiction, it's kind of like no turning back. You can't stop. And so 7-OH is an alkaloid that is inside the kratom plant. And they say it's, you know, 10 to 20 times more powerful than morphine. And so somebody figured out how that you can oxidize the kratom material, the kratom leaf material, and so that you can just then extract the most potent part of it, put it in a tablet. And yes, if you take that, what happened to Cameron over maybe 2 or 3 months can happen in 2 or 3 days. Yes, so it's awful. It is terrible. But to answer your question, isn't it interesting? When you take kratom, there is only a small amount of 7-OH in the plant. Yeah, that's true. But when you take it in the liver, it is being metabolized. Part of it is being metabolized into 7-OH, the very thing that we're now saying we should schedule. That's really the issue. The 7-OH undoubtedly is the worst. Metrogenine is the primary alkaloid in kratom. Okay, so you hear metrogenine all the time. Real quick, the kratom industry, especially the American Kratom Association, they like to get out there and say, oh, metrogenine, it's just a partial agonist, and it's not that bad. It's a weak opioid-like product or compound, and don't worry about it. You can't have respiratory depression, even though the FDA says you can. And and they paint this pretty picture, but what they leave out of their story is it's the very metrogenine that is metabolizing in the liver to 7-hydroxymetrogenine. And when that binds to the opioid receptor, it's far more. That's where most of the opioid effects are coming from. And so, yes, if you start taking kratom kratom too much, too often, you're likely to become addicted, which is what the American Psychology Association, I think I'm saying that, or Psychiatric Association says. You're likely to. But anyway, that's the answer to your question there.
So, just out of curiosity, your son was, when he became involved with this, did he just read about it or see it, or did he have friends who were using it, or... I mean, because I'm sure all those things happened to a lot of people.
YouTube.
YouTube.
It was on YouTube. The industry definitely did a good job of finding, influencers and even colleges that would let them come and give handouts of kratom to their athletes. I mean, there's been a lot of bad stuff that has occurred along the way because of what you said earlier, like the physician who kind of drank the Kool-Aid and like, oh, I heard it was great for opioids, like... No, we have a process. It's called the FDA for stuff like that. You actually go through clinical safety trials first before you market things like that, which is, by the way, side note, that's what the American Medical Association says should be done. They've been saying it since 2023. They're not trying to say that kratom is inherently bad. They're saying maybe there's some good, maybe there's some positives that could occur from it. That's fine, but you must go through your rigorous clinical safety trials and regulatory evaluation before you bring a product that works on the opioid receptors into the market. By the way, this might make sense. Like, Amazon doesn't sell it. Walmart doesn't sell it.
Oh, really?
Target, you don't think they've tried? None of those places. Zero. They're the only place that you can get it, except for online, directly from the manufacturers, is through a smoke shop. Or what I hate to say, I would call a low-end gas station. And it's just people that just don't—they're just there to make a profit. Nobody cares. Amazon is smart enough; they would end up in the biggest lawsuit ever. They're not going to do that. I mean, that should speak volumes to people. But Cameron, right. So Cameron was it was a YouTube influencer, and the guy literally took it in the YouTube video. And kind of sat there and about, 5 minutes later going, man, that just kind of feels good. I feel a little more chatty. I'm kind of upbeat. And he kept emphasizing the fact that it's a plant, and it's healthy. It's a supplement. And, hey, it sounds great. Anyway, Cameron, I forget, at some point in the future, wrote to the guy. And the guy actually responded. Cameron's surprised, because he had a pretty big audience. And he responded to Cameron. And he said, I am so sorry. He said, I got addicted too. I had no idea what was happening with it. I am dreadfully sorry. It was obviously, so he got duped into it, just, like a lot of others.
Wow. They get duped into it because of the money. Yeah. Hi, do you want to sell this for us?
Yeah.
What exactly is it? Just out of curiosity, like what is this stuff? Because we deal with, with all the stuff with marijuana, and people say, oh, it's natural. I'm like, you should go out where they grow it and see the 55-gallon drums of, Chinese pesticides, herbicides, yeah. rodenticides, and spray adhesive. That's my favorite. It grows like a plant, but it's not. Is that this stuff too?
Quick side note. I've been to Reading a few times. Remember, I'm in Richmond, and it's kind of funny. My son actually ran with the director, kind of the lead for a whitewater rafting program out there for a few summers, and they used to laugh because you're near Weed, California.
We know.
And I'm like, wow, that's something. Okay.
They have a whole store about it. We could send you some iHeart Weed shirts. Okay. You could, you know, modify those for your...
Yeah.
You could wear them to work.
Anyway... Yeah, okay. So, what is it? It is a leaf that comes from a tree that is in Southeast Asia.
Oh.
And you'll find this really interesting. The industry says it's been used safely for hundreds of years and you know, it's all this home remedy stuff and it's all this, I mean, they just downplay it, you know, all this kind of stuff. But what they leave out, they always leave stuff out. No pun intended. Leave. I just thought about that.
They leave it out.
Okay. They leave out. It is prohibited from domestic sales inside of 4 of the 5 countries in which it's grown.
Oh, wow.
In other words, if you want to...
I can hear Alex in the booth and they're going, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the most duplicitous, devious, dubious industry I have ever known or heard. I mean, it's just like, I'm sure there's some others that are similar, but this is really, it gets outrageous. Many of the people behind it used to be in prison. I can go on. But, so you could pull it off a leaf, right? Let's say I'm a laborer, okay? It's hot. It's Southeast Asia. And so I need just a little, you know, pick me up. Well, I might grab a chew on it, okay? But you're talking about an extraordinarily minimal amount of nitrogenine, okay? You're talking about, like, it's just what we're doing is we're taking the leaves, we're then crushing them, or drying them, and then crushing them, and putting it into a powder. So I don't know what the exact, you know, how many leaves per, you know, a few grams of powder or whatever, but we're talking about a lot of leaves being crushed, and now you're increasing. Think about codeine for a second. You know, codeine is an opioid, which is why you can't buy it at a gas station.
Sure.
Right? There has to be something. There's a medical oversight. But if you take enough, that's considered a weak opioid. If you take enough codeine, okay. It's now converting into morphine. And, I mean, it's dangerous. That's why you can't just go buy as much codeine as you want. It's the same concept. So a little leaf off a tree, okay, maybe not so bad, and maybe somebody brews it, brewing, you know, some people might do a little bit of that. But you're just still talking about a very small amount. You're not talking about the frequency. People today their intake is so much more. And it's daily, and it doesn't take much. You build tolerance, and you're being sold the whole time in our culture that it's a plant-based herbal supplement, so you think it's okay. You think your state lawmakers have protected you. No way that they would allow an opioid to be sold in this gas station. That's not possible. And but that's where it comes from. And then what they also do, by the way, the people listening who are the part of the kratom industry right now, which is usually represented by the American Kratom Association, they hate the story I'm telling you about Cameron because I keep referring to it as the powder. The powder. That is the most natural product or natural form of kratom here in the United States. It's not as natural as a leaf, okay? That's like barely, hardly anything. But they hate it. Because what they want to do is they want to blame 7OH for the problem. Okay, that's their big thing that they do today. They're trying to say, oh, these problems with Kratom, oh, it's not Kratom, it's the 7OH group, or it's these bad people who kind of enhance their products. Well, anyway, in the middle, okay, starting around 2020, 2021, the industry couldn't help themselves, and they went from the Kratom powder to what are called extracts. So now what they decided to do is get it into, usually it's a liquid,
And so you're now like a massive amount of metrogenine. You look on the, when you see, no one's reading these labels, right? No one's reading anything on them. Okay. But if you did, it would say metrogenine, which nobody knows what that is, but it's the primary compound inside the plant. And so now, like, you might shake up a little bit of powder, and that may have been, I don't know, 30 to 50 milligrams of metrogenine, which is, you know, still a pretty decent amount. But in an extract, there might be 150 to 250 milligrams of metrogenine. So now you know, and it might say on there, only take half the bottle. Okay, right. It's like a shot. It's like a tiny little shot. And now all of a sudden people are taking massive amounts of metrogenine. They have no idea. And like I said before, that's metabolizing in the liver to 7-hydroxy, which is why people will get addicted to an extract even faster than they do the powder.
It's just like marijuana.
It is the exactly same thing. It's the gummy bears and
it really mimics.
There you go.
The whole cocaine process. Yeah. I mean, the people that grow it chew the leaves, you know, for a pick me up, and then they process the leaves and make cocaine. The same thing. It's natural.
It's just like the marijuana and making the dabs.
I think that's why we call these things drugs.
No.
That's it? Oh my gosh, there's the common thread. And it's filled with lies. Okay, we have to play a song about lying and then take a brief commercial break here. We'll be right back. We're going to switch to decaf now, Dean. I hope you're happy. We're all moving to decaf. This is not the show where you should be drinking coffee. His website is End Kratom Addiction. Our guest is Dean Francis. You can find all of it at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Have you stopped into Harmony yet? We'd love to welcome you in. We've thoughtfully curated brands we truly love, from Lululemon, Vuori, Free People Movement to The Upside, alongside beautiful home goods, clean body care, candles, gifts, and everyday pieces you'll reach for again and again. We believe shopping should feel inspiring, not overwhelming. Come slow down, explore, and discover something you didn't know you needed. We're located in the heart of downtown Reading on California Street between Curated and Theory Coffee, right next to Organic Pilates. We can't wait to welcome you into Harmony.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Craving something delicious and refreshing? Come try the new blackened chicken and shrimp salad at Charlie's Tap House, your perfect summer treat. And don't forget the big flippin' pizza, all 36 inches of it. Bring the whole crew. Our kid-friendly party room keeps you entertained while you dine. Then cool off with our homemade gelato with flavors changing every week. See you at happy hour 7 days a week from 3 to 6 with appetizers, beer and wine, and 25% off the beer wall where you pay by the ounce, local beer rotating. Charlie's Tap House, located in the Shasta Gateway. Great food, great fun, and the flavors of summer waiting for you.
Got an old car sitting in your yard? Donate it to Reading Piano Angels. We accept all kinds of vehicles. Cars, trucks, RVs, boats, motorcycles, even trailers and go-karts. Thanks to local support, Piano Angels has provided over 600 pianos to families, schools, churches, senior homes, and nonprofits across Northern California. Donate today by visiting readingpianoangels.com or call 530-510-1903. That's 530-510-1903.
I want.
when Kathy doesn't have to do drug education anymore. Because we banned it all, we admitted it was drugs, and now we could move on and live our lives. Happily ever after.
I wish.
So during the break, we were talking, Kathy has some articles over there about deaths
attributed stemming to kratom. Is it an overdose? Like, what is causing the deaths related to kratom?
Yeah, so according to the CDC, from 2020 to 2024, they reported 5,208 kratom-involved overdose deaths. So that means that they were designated to be overdosed, and kratom was present. So to determine cause, that's a deeper level of toxicology and medical examiners. And so sometimes you get people to go in and do the deep dive to determine the exact cause. Other times you don't. You just classify it as an overdose death. What's interesting about that number, though, is that did not include states of California, Florida, or Texas, and a few others. Okay? And I also want to just point this out, that and the CDC acknowledges all this, that a lot of labs weren't even testing for it.
Right.
Didn't have the technology to, because it's new, right? And so you can quickly extrapolate, just throw in a couple more years or a couple other states. The number is well over 10,000 people have experienced, there's been an overdose death where kratom was present. What's interesting is that the industry, the American Kratom Association primarily leading the cause, is trying to dismiss all these deaths as what they call polysubstance, polydrug. Basically saying, well, there was another drug involved somewhere in their system, whether it was a prescribed medicine or an illicit drug, and therefore you can't blame kratom, you know? And it's like, wow. What a coincidence. Over 10,000 people died, and you don't think kratom had to do anything with it? And anyway, go over to the FDA website. It's there right now. And it indicates on there that kratom inhibits liver enzymes that are necessary to metabolize even some of the most common prescriptions and over-the-counter medications as simple as Benadryl. And so there are so many stories. I've talked with these parents. It's so heartbreaking. But you'll hear about someone who was taking their prescribed amount of pain medication or anxiety medication or maybe just some additional Benadryl at night to help them sleep. It could also be because of anxiety. It doesn't matter. But they start taking kratom because they heard that kratom is a natural alternative to a pain med or to an anxiety med, and they are unaware of the fact that it can inhibit these very liver enzymes from metabolizing the other medications. And in these stories, it's not like an instant death, but it's like weeks, sometimes months later, and boom, this 27-year-old is dead. This 35-year-old person is dead. Those stories are extremely common. And so, anyway, that kind of gives you an idea of some of the data on death.
Well, when you had to take your son to the emergency room, why did you go to the emergency room?
Because he thought he was going to die. He wakes us up, it's, I don't know, 1 or 2
oh,
morning,
okay.
You know, and he feels like he's going to die. What was happening in his case, he was in a full state of withdrawal, and he didn't know it. He didn't know what a full state of withdrawal was, right? You have to remember, like, he was struggling with the alcohol at this point, we think that's kind of the issue, and he's doing things to stop and not use alcohol. And if you do that, now there's nothing to medicate the opioid withdrawal. And that's what happened. The opioid withdrawal went into a full state. He probably had no kratom at that point. He's broke. And so we rushed him in. The doctor looks at him and is like, son, you're on drugs. What are you taking? Because the doctor could see he was in a full state of withdrawal. And they kind of, a little argument ensued because Cameron's like, I'm not on drugs, you know. When Cameron said kratom, the doctor had to go back and look it up. Didn't know, especially back in 2021, didn't know what it was. And came back in the room, his eyes were kind of big, and it's like, this is an opioid, and you need serious help.
This something that could be accidentally, in, like, for instance, in the marijuana world, we have gummy bears, we have, people that are baking brownies. We have all of this. And if you use this in a product and a young person gets a hold of it, is it something that would really affect them or cause death?
If something else was laced into it?
Well, the kratom. What I'm saying is using kratom is putting it in different products.
Yeah,
and someone that has never used kratom before all of a sudden is getting a massive dose of it.
Like they put it in some kind of, you know,
yeah,
punch or something at a party.
I see, yeah. Well, it's very popular to actually mix it with kava. There's a lot of kava, but in Florida, that's their issue.
Oh,
they have all these kava bars, and the kava bars have begun to add kratom. In fact, the second most popular kratom product in the United States is a kratom kava product called Feel Free. And anyone just Googles it, YouTubes it, whatever, you will be shocked at what you see. It's the number of people that claim they get addicted to it fast is unbelievable. You're only supposed to, it says on the warning label, only take one of these a day. But we had a distributor from that previous distributor who used to work at the company who swears in front of lawmakers that that he was embedded into his head that the average person buying 6 bottles of Feel Free a day. And so he would give them out as free samples, knowing the potential of that. You know, these are anecdotal stories, but you have lots of people. You can walk into a store and you ask people about the Feel Free, and they'll be like, yeah, people are coming in here, and they buy one or two, and then they're back and a few weeks later. They're buying 6 at a time, 12 at a time, a case, you know. Anyway, so the mixture of kratom and kava, we don't understand why, but there's kind of like an additional boost. That doesn't necessarily kill someone that hasn't taken kratom before, which I know was your original question.
No, I just was curious. Is it a thing that just sends them over the top, or, you know, like little kids, you know, in a lot of our programming THC and stuff, like little kids will wake up in the morning on Saturday and the parents have, you know, left all these THC gummies and things that look like kids' food, and they eat them and wind up in the ER. Does this have that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, there's high risk. When you get into little kids that were to get a hold of this, it's very high risk, scary stories. Let me go down, though, to, I'm kind of skipping that, but it's worth me saying it. It's on the FDA website. It's neonatal withdrawal.
Terrific.
It is awful. Here this industry is out there saying it's not an opioid, but yet lots of cases. You have neonatal withdrawal, which is the most horrifying thing that I could even think of. And so, you know, moms that got addicted to kratom, they can't stop. And, you know, their child is born like this. So it's extremely scary. I saw a story just last week of a 15-year-old who died. He was also doing marijuana, but that led to kratom. And I think you're right. The idea being that, you know, he didn't have much tolerance, whatever, it's harder. I don't know, but he's dead.
Well, and we should point out on your YouTube channel that we have linked here, and the YouTube channel is easy. It's End Kratom Addiction, so, you know, pretty simple. Go to YouTube. But we did put these on the page, Kratom Fundamentals. So you do have a whole video that shows the Feel Free and all that on your site, and that does exist on YouTube. So people can, you know, get a little smarter. And, you know, the thing is, as a parent, probably would have helped you if you knew what you were looking at. You could have helped your son.
Yeah. I mean, oh, my gosh. Yeah, he would have never taken it. Like, if he would have ever, and he said it a million times, like, if I would have had any idea this was kind of in the level of, you know, near heroin type stuff, I would have never, ever, like, he's trying to run a 4-minute mile.
Yeah, right.
So, by the way, speaking of the YouTube channel, there's an episode where I did just a couple weeks ago where I interviewed 2 attorneys who are 4, almost 5 years into wrongful death lawsuits against Peyton Paleo. Now, you've probably not heard that name before, but it's worth, this really will kind of connect all your dots for you. You probably remember Spice and K2.
Uh-huh. Yep.
The synthetic cannabinoids, right? They killed tons of people. Well, the central figure behind Spice was Peyton Paleo. And once that business was eventually shut down, he's the one that really was kind of like the grandfather of the kratom industry. In 2012, he created a company, a kratom company, called OPM. Opium. And he later changed it to OPMS. Yeah, it was actually opmkratom.com. And then it was so explicit, he eventually changed it to OPMS. It's the largest seller of kratom in the United States. And under deposition and so forth, they were able to determine that he is actually the founder of the American Kratom Association, the very organization that goes in front of lawmakers every day with their paid scientists telling everybody, oh, kratom is safe. It's kind of like Oxycontin. It's really not addictive, and nobody really dies. You can't die from it. They say all these things. It's literally funded by all of this. It's coming from the same guy behind Spice. They kind of give whatever details they can. They are limited because of the lawsuits, but they estimate somewhere between 20 and 40 wrongful death lawsuits now that are against him. And, it's just, the whole thing is just frightening. It just needs to end.
Is this your video, Kratom Uncovered, the Predators Behind?
Yeah,
that one. Okay. So I have that one linked on there as well. And, yeah, it's 58 minutes. I was able to watch quite a bit of that yesterday. This whole thing, I think, is in a weird way flying under the radar a bit.
I had a question. I guess California has banned kratom.
Yep.
But they're still selling it.
Great question.
Why? How are they getting away with it?
Yeah. Your Department of Health has established that it is unlawful. And so it is illegal to sell kratom in the state of California. However, enforcement is another issue. And so you've kind of got a mess there in California. You do have, I believe, some towns or counties that have come out and banned it. They have the right to do that. And in fact, total across the country now, it is 277 localities that have banned kratom. It is 12 states that have fully banned it completely. But then there's these kind of quasi-states. Yours would be one of them, California. Like, the Department of Health says
we
it's
are
illegal,
kind of a quasi-state,
sort of
aren't
there.
We?
Yeah, and Utah got it almost all the way banned. Ohio has gotten almost all the way banned. In those states, I think it's still just the powder is available. And so there's definitely been, in the last 12 months, this has been extraordinary. So there's a massive movement now that's occurring. Lawmakers are finally beginning to catch up to it. They just need to hear the right side.
Hmm. Wow.
Let me ask you this. Your son was an athlete, and I know they drug test athletes at a lot of these events. Do they drug test for kratom?
I don't think so. Don't quote me on that. I mean, certainly they weren't testing for that back in his day, because he would have been happy for someone to have taught it and said, hey, you can't do this. That would have been great. So it definitely wasn't happening then. It might be happening now. I think I've heard a lot of people say that kratom is not a part of most drug tests still.
Putting Kathy on this one. Kathy's on the case. We'll report back. She's gonna go bird dog that one.
Yeah, I am.
This whole thing is crazy. We have probably have about another 30 seconds, and so we don't want to unceremoniously just escape when the news comes on. Our guest has been Dean Francis. He founded the End Kratom Addiction group, I guess, but you can find him at endkratomaddiction.org. Dean, we really appreciate you coming on with us. And you know what? Give Cameron a pat on the back, because it's not easy to be the face of, like, your worst day and let that continue to be super public. So kudos to all of you.
That's probably a good way to finish. It's a good way to finish, because kudos to him. I could never have done this if it weren't for him. He was the one that went public with his story prior to me starting End Kratom Addiction to warn other people. And so now today that he is very, very healthy, he is fired up, because it's like his chance to be a part of the movement that fights back and kind of destroys.
Well, perhaps when we do this again, he'll want to pop on and be his own voice. Yeah. We would be happy to have him. Dean Francis, we have to run away.
Yeah.
We're sorry. We should have had more time.
Thank
you.
For having me.
Absolutely.
You bet.
KCNR, Shasta Reddy.
News this hour from Town Hall, I'm Mary Rose. A federal appeals court ruling is triggering a new fight over political advertising rates, with both parties pressuring local TV stations ahead of the 2026 midterms. Correspondent Ron Taylor reports.
The Fourth Circuit overturned an FCC rule allowing political parties and super PACs to receive the same discounted rates as individual candidates. Axios reports Democrats are saying stations could face campaign finance violations if they offer outside groups those discounts. Republican attorneys disagree, calling the Democratic warning legally unsupported and threatening complaints against stations that change their policies. Republicans plan to appeal the ruling, which could determine how far campaign dollars go this fall. Ron Taylor reporting.
New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani is taking another shot at Amazon, and critics warn shoppers could pay the price. Correspondent Richard Boyd reports.
Mayor Mamdani supports a Teamsters-backed bill requiring Amazon to directly hire delivery couriers. One study estimates the mandate could add $664 a year to the average New York household's costs, while putting up to 5,000 jobs at risk. Critics say the policy could drive operations out of the city, making deliveries slower and more expensive. Richard Boyd reporting.
Iran's economy could face increasing pressure as the Trump administration urges other countries to cut financial ties with Tehran. The effort gained momentum after the United Arab Emirates suspended trade relations with Iran, with few major trading partners remaining. China is seen as Iran's strongest economic lifeline. Russia is focused on its own war. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Larry Elder here. When it comes to supplements, two things matter most: that it works and that you can trust it. Rather than just tell you about Relief Factor, we'll let our customers do it. We hear from people every single day whose lives have changed, and we'd like you to hear a few of their stories as well. Jim ran out of Relief Factor twice, and both times his aches, stiffness, and pain came back. Once he restarted it, he says he felt better again. As Jim puts it, you know something's working when you run out of it. I take Relief Factor every single morning for my back issues. I know exactly what Jim is talking about. Now, they make it easy for you to find out if you'll be the next person telling us Relief Factor helped you tackle your daily aches and pain. 3 weeks for just $17.76. Simply go to ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com, or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. You'll connect with our friendly local team, and they will do everything they can to help. We hope you'll soon be sharing your story with us as well. 800-4-RELIEF. ReliefFactor.com.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested nearly 50,000 people in July, the highest single monthly arrest total during the second Trump administration, according to new figures. Reporter Bernie Bennett has the details.
The July arrest tally of 49,571 marks a 15% jump from 43,021 arrests a month earlier, and a 70% increase from 29,241 in February, according to government data provided by ICE to the Deportation Data Project based at UC Berkeley and UCLA. The agency has increasingly relied on state and local law enforcement partners who are assuming immigration enforcement duties. Bernie Bennett reporting.
NASA is making history with today's launch of a powerful new telescope. The Nancy Grace Roman Telescope rocketed into space from Cape Canaveral, Florida, aboard SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket this morning. Breaking news at townhall.com. Juul is updating its vaping device.
The Food and Drug Administration is giving Juul Labs permission to sell an updated version of its vaping device. It includes an optional age verification system designed to prevent use by anyone underage. Juul plans to market the new device under the brand name Juul 2, along with updated versions of its tobacco and menthol-flavored cartridges. In 2019, the company discontinued several flavors, including mango, mint, and cream, that drove most of its sales, but were favored by teenagers. Juul says any new flavors will be targeted to adult nicotine customers. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Wildfires continue to burn near California's Big Sur. The fast-moving Plaskett fire has grown to 8,000 acres and remains uncontained and has forced evacuation south of Monterey. More on the stories at townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio on August 30th, 2026. My name is Erin Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
So, the first hour, basically today we're talking about drugs. So, the first hour we talked about Kratom, a.k.a. gas station heroin. Nothing good going on there, and I would venture to guess most of us are kind of dumb about it, actually. I was dumb about it. And we do lots of shows about drugs. So if you would like to know more, our archives are always posted at wethepeopleradio.us. Our friend Robert Exter takes out the free enterprise moments. Sorry, Phil. I know you're a big free enterprise guy. We love free enterprise, but we do take those moments out and provide the recording uninterrupted for people to use however they would like. This hour, we're talking about legal drugs and the manipulation thereof. So our guest, Phil Kirpin, he's a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. He previously worked at the Free Enterprise Fund, Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. Kirpin, as it says, I hate doing it like that. I'm going to change it. Phil is also a nationally syndicated columnist, chairman of the Internet Freedom Network, Freedom Coalition, and author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. He is currently the president of American Commitment, dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets. Yay! Economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. You can't go wrong with any of those things. Their website is AmericanCommitment.org. All right, Phil. We always, whenever you come on, we just like pull the ripcord and let it go.
I was going to say, that was a very comprehensive introduction. I don't even, you know.
Well, because we knew it was just going to be like a blast of information from there, so I figured I'd better put all that in there
and then let you go.
It's
a very interesting time right now on drug policy, and I mean legal drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, biopharmaceuticals. I don't get too much into the drugs of abuse, which I guess was your last...
that's why I thought it was kind of funny. You guys were both available on the same day. I'm like, wow.
It's interesting. Well, you know, we just had something very interesting. The most recent inflation data that posted for the month of July, the 12-month change in prices for the prescription drug component of the consumer price index was actually down by 3.1%, which is the largest 12-month decline we've ever seen in that particular component. Now, I know you're thinking, well, 3% is nothing. How do you even notice? But, you know, the point is these things usually go up. It's very unusual to have a decrease of any size, and in fact, that's the largest decrease we've seen since they started keeping that statistic in 1970. And if you look at the chart of what prescription drug prices have done in recent years, it's pretty interesting because you've got a big decline, a big deceleration in prices in the first Trump term. Then you got a big spike under Biden, which, you know, as price of everything spiked under Biden, so it's not surprising that happened also. And now we've got this decline under Trump. And yet, you know, you look at the headlines and news coverage, and I swear they're trying to give Biden credit for prescription drug prices coming down under Trump. They say, oh, this is the fruits of his brilliant Inflation Reduction Act. Of course, you know, the opposite is true. That was probably the most oppositely named bill of what it actually was since the Affordable Care Act. Everything that bill touched got more expensive, not less expensive, including, by the way, they said we're going to have these huge savings on prescription drugs from that bill, and they did, you know, they did a bunch of price controls, which they promised were going to bring down drug prices, and they did a redesign of the Part D benefit, and they said it's going to save Medicare all this money, it's going to bring down the prices of drugs. It did the opposite. Medicare spending on drugs is actually up a lot, and in fact, towards the end of the Biden administration, because the redesign of that bill had failed so badly and all the Part D plans were filing for huge premium increases, they basically bribed them with taxpayer money to prevent that from happening on their watch, thinking it would get them through the election, and that left a mess in Trump's lap. But what actually has worked to bring down prices are a number of Trump policies, and I think the most significant one is probably direct-to-consumer sales, which they've done by promoting Trump RX and direct sales from the manufacturers and Mark Cuban's site and a bunch of other channels. They put some other rules on PBMs, although it's not quite as strong as some of us would like to have seen, and they're getting tougher in negotiations, both with foreign countries, and we got the UK to agree to pay more for brand drugs. We're hoping we can get a similar agreement from Europe and Japan. And the Trump administration also secured major commitments to bring production back to the U.S. and to invest in the U.S. And so you look at kind of this mix of policies, and I think the key is we've got more competition than we've ever had before, not just in terms of drugs competing with other drugs, but we've got distribution channels now competing, which by what I mean by that is you don't only have the choice of going to the pharmacy counter or ordering through your insurance company. You now also have the choice of ordering direct from manufacturer or through Trump RX or through, you know, Mark Cuban's Cost Plus drugs. And when people have a lot of choices of different ways to buy something, that makes it very difficult for the middlemen that have large markups to sustain those markups, because now if they're adding a bunch of cost in the distribution, you've got an alternative. You've got another way to go, and I think that's put pretty significant downward pressure on price. Now, we are still dealing with the consequences of the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of government price setting for the drugs that get put on the list for that process. And, you know, the interesting thing about that to me is that, you know, the problem with government setting prices is by definition, they always set them wrong. And I think the assumption is usually that they're going to set them too low for political reasons. And, of course, that causes shortages, it causes underinvestment, it causes a lot of problems. But often they set them too high because, you know, the company might have influence in various ways. They might be worried about causing those problems. And so, you know, you get distortions in all directions when you have government price setting. And a lot of the specific details of how the price setting program under Inflation Reduction Act have been done have been very perverse. In particular, you know, for instance, for cancer drugs, they benchmark the price for new cutting-edge cancer drugs on old chemotherapy agents. Well, if you do that, you're going to set a price that's too low, and new cancer drugs aren't going to be developed, and now you've created a disincentive to do clinical trials, because if it pans out, you might not be able to make a return on investment. So we've seen a lot of clinical trials canceled. We've got a situation now where they're suggesting that the price controls be agnostic on the method of administration, which is to say, if you've got an older version of a drug that takes, you know, 3 hours sitting in an infusion chair, and the company figures out how to develop one that you can take in a shot at your doctor's office, and boom, and you're done, and you don't need to travel to an infusion center, you don't need to sit there, well, they're going to treat those as the same drug, and they're going to price them as if they're the same. And if they do that, well, no one's going to develop the easier-to-administer right. version if they already have the other one. And so, you know, they've got some very perverse incentives in that program. I would like to see the Trump administration be much more aggressive in rolling back all the stuff that Biden did, and leaning harder into, you know, just promoting competition and choice and transparency and getting a functional market. And by the way, and I'll shut up because I know I am rambling a little bit.
I recently
discovered, you know, when you have a drug filled at a pharmacy, they by default, they'll use your insurance and they'll fill it at whatever the insurance price is and present it to you. They're not allowed, most generally, they are not allowed to tell you what the cash price is, because they have contracts with the insurance companies that require them not to unless you specifically ask.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so what I've started doing lately is if I go in to pick up a prescription and they're like, oh, that's $57, I'll say, oh, can you get me a better cash price? And then they look it up and they're like, oh, how about $25? Yeah, that's better. I'll go with that. So I've been amazed to discover that, you know, often the pharmacy prices are not even, they don't even have a choice. It's set by the insurance company, not the pharmacist. And here's the crazy thing, because I go to an independent pharmacy, so I ask them, I'm like, I don't want to put you guys out. If I take that lower price, do you make less money? Is that bad for you? They said, no, it's better for us, because when you take the insurance price, we have to kick most of the money up to them. With the cash price, we can keep it.
No, wow. Fooling.
So you talked about bringing...
My wife calls me cheap for asking now, but, you know, I say why not? Why
I
not?
Like it.
Well, you were talking about bringing the drug manufacturing back to the U.S. Is it cheaper to manufacture the drugs overseas and then sell them over here? Because, I mean, everything else you make overseas is cheaper. How do they regulate that?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it might be a little bit cheaper overseas, but we have these are very high tech facilities, and there's a lot of capital that goes into them. The labor costs are not the major element of it, and of course, we have the best, most productive workers in the world, and so it makes all the sense in the world. Especially the other reason that I think all these companies should locate most of their production in the U.S. is we're the ones that are paying for all the medical innovation globally in terms of new drugs being developed.
Right.
We still have these, the other rich countries have price controls on their drugs. So, I mean, you know, if you've got all these, you know, international companies that are making essentially all of their money in the U.S. because their price controls in these other countries, well, they ought to be located here. I don't think it's an unreasonable ask from the president. And, you know, the other aspect of what he's doing, which, you know, I'm pretty optimistic about, if you think about it, you know, we've now got this template. We've got this deal that he did with the United Kingdom, which, by the way, everybody said, you're never going to convince a country to pay more for brand drugs. Don't even bother asking. They're never going to agree to that. Well, I mean, the UK did agree to that, and they're going to pay substantially more for U.S. brand drugs than they have been. If we can get that same deal with Europe, if we could convince Europe, hey, let drugs sell at a market price instead of at a government-set lower price, Just think about it. Right now, the U.S. is carrying the whole weight of developing new drugs and bringing them to market because we're the only place you can really get a market return on that capital. If Europe became like us in that regard, the addressable global market for new pharmaceuticals essentially doubles. We'd get so many new drugs developed, and every time you have a class with competition with multiple drugs, you'd have lower prices as well. So we would have a lot more new drugs. We would have lower prices. And by the way, this is the craziest part. Most of the European countries actually spend more overall on drugs than we do. It's just they spend more overall because they don't have the generic penetration the way we do. Most of them have protectionist policies for their own domestic generic manufacturers. So unlike here in the U.S., where once something goes generic, the price, you know, collapses to almost nothing, in Europe, when something goes generic, the price comes down, you know, only a little bit because they favor their own generic manufacturers and they want them to make money. The only losers, if they adopted a pricing model more like ours, the only losers would be the generic manufacturers in Europe who benefit right now from protectionism. But, you know, if they had a model more like ours where you do pay a lot more for new drugs when they're new, but then they very rapidly get inexpensive when they're off patent, we would have more new drugs developed globally, and they could actually agree to it without spending more, just spending more intelligently. So I think it's an achievable trade objective. There, I know there's been a bill introduced to create a deputy U.S. trade rep just to deal with this issue, and I think, you know, the numbers are so big. The more sort of effort we can put into this, the better. But, you know, the fact that we got that concession from the U.K., now that's a small market in the grand scheme of things. It's not going to have a huge impact. But if that could become the template, I mean, that could just be huge because the other rich countries get a free ride from us.
Yeah. Right.
The president is completely right about this. It's unbelievable. We pay for the $1 billion cost of developing a new drug or treatment, and then they just get it at a government-set price, much cheaper. Now, they usually don't get it for a few years because the manufacturer tries to hold out for a better price and so forth. So they pay a little bit of a weight in exchange for it, but it's ridiculous. They're getting a free ride off of us. And so, you know, if the president could succeed in addressing that, that would be huge. Now, I don't love the idea, you know, sometimes he says the way he wants to do that is we'll just link our prices to their prices, whatever it is. And the problem there is, if their prices are still government set and they're too low and they can't justify, you know, R&D and development of new cures, and we just link to theirs, well, then there's nobody to get a free ride off of. But if we can get them to meet us in the middle, if we can hardball them in trade negotiations, it could be a huge win-win.
Yeah, because I don't think people really think about the R&D cost on some of these drugs, and that, I mean, they have to recoup that. I mean, it's not free.
They don't invent themselves, right?
Yeah. No.
Well, we just got a big breakthrough. It looks like there's finally going to be an effective drug for pancreatic cancer, which, you know, we all know someone who's had that. That's like the worst one, and now maybe it won't be. So, I mean, there continues to be remarkable medical innovation that's going on, and, you know, it's easy to say, oh, just do more government research or whatever, NIH or what have you, but the private sector capacity is so much larger than anything that the governments could do, and more effective also for a variety of reasons. And you'd have to have the incentives right for that to continue. And that's why, you know, the Biden policy of just, hey, when a drug is successful, we're going to throw government price control on it, well, that messes up the whole penciling out of developing new drugs.
Sure does.
Say, wait a second, we want to be successful, but not too successful, because we don't want to be on the list that gets waxed with the government price control. And then, of course, you know, on the other side, then the government's worried, well, you know, if we set the price control wrong and we discourage research, and so they might end up setting the price too high, and especially if they're subject to lobbying influence and so forth. That's why what you want is a market mechanism. And ideally, you want one with as broad a market as possible, i.e. get these other countries to pay market prices. So I think there's a way that all these Trump policies come together that works really successfully. And I think what we've seen so far, pretty good. I mean, look, it's only a 3% decrease, but it's a decrease, okay?
Yeah, right. It's going down and not up. Yeah, going the right direction.
Amazing. And, you know, that's why it drives me nuts when I see these people trying to credit Biden for it, which I have seen in the media.
Well, there's so much in the media that makes us all go nuts, which is why we still do the show 15 years later.
Well, I didn't really want to correct you earlier, but you did use Biden and brilliance in the same sentence, which
it was an accident.
Kind of concerned
me. It was ironic.
It was just garden variety alliteration.
Okay.
We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Phil Kirpin. He is the president of American Commitment. You can see all of the information at wethepeopleradio.us.
Seems everything I buy these days has got a foreign name. From the kind of car I drive to my video game.
I got a Nikon camera. Color TV.
But the one that I love is from the USA, standing next to me.
The sea, blue, vast, ever in motion. You remember how you felt the sky and that breeze carrying the scent of the high seas. That sense of calm, tranquility, aware of your small place atop that deep blue ocean. Deep Blue by Casa Carrillo. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Craving something delicious and refreshing? Come try the new Black and Chicken and Shrimp Salad at Charlie's Tap House, your perfect summer treat. And don't forget the big flippin' pizza, all 36 inches of it. Bring the whole crew. Our kid-friendly party room keeps you entertained while you dine. Then cool off with our homemade gelato with flavors changing every week. See you at happy hour 7 days a week from 3 to 6 with appetizers, beer and wine, and 25% off the beer wall where you pay by the ounce. Local beer rotating. Charlie's Tap House, located in the Shasta Gateway. Great food, great fun, and the flavors of summer waiting for you.
Shasta County. Tired of filtered news? Welcome to Shasta Unfiltered, your trusted online newspaper for the North State. Straight facts on Redding politics, city council moves, local events, and the national stories that actually hit your wallet, like federal funding changes and job trends right here at home. No agenda, no paid spin disguised as news. Just honest reporting and the stories you need. Visit ShastaUnfiltered.com. Your community reported right.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Hip to knock the USA. It was so awful and we're so bad. You ought to check the nightlife and live in grass. It ain't even close. Better in the USA.
It's better in the USA.
You can see behind the curtain. Life is cold and gray.
It's better in the USA.
How can I make you understand it's better in the USA?
Talking to Phil, where the Oak Ridge Boys meet Glenn Frey. Go make sense of that. So Phil, in the article that we attached for today, the one you wrote with Stephen Moore, you guys at the very beginning of this you know, with the inflation,
Reduction
Act, right? Imposed government price controls on prescription drugs by replacing the old non-interference. And so then at the end of this, it says in which the manufacturer has to agree or face punitive seizure via taxes equal to 95% of the product's total sales. Can you like draw a better, like a longer or a more comprehensive picture? How is it that we're getting away with that? What the heck?
Right. So it's kind of amazing. I don't like to call it negotiation, even though that's the word that the law uses for this. But it really is government price setting, because if you get put on this list, it's basically a lobbying exercise. I mean, you do go in a room and you make your argument for why the price should be what you think it should be. But at the end of that, the government's going to set the price, because if you don't agree, if the quote-unquote negotiation fails, if you don't agree to a price, then you get taxed 95% of your gross sales of that product.
So that is not a negotiation, according to anyone's...
That's not profit. That's gross sales. That's the total sales amount that you have of that product, which no company could sustain, obviously, because you had all of your costs associated with producing and distributing it, and 95% of that is going to be much, much, much more than your profits were. And so, it's essentially like an economic death penalty. And so it's this is basically just price setting with, a bunch of deceptive language around it, so that, they can, they know from polls that people like the idea of negotiation. So they say, oh, it's negotiation. But it's not. It's government price setting. And, of course, they don't know what the price should be, and so that's why, you get into all the specifics of how they're setting the price, and there are all these mistakes, and as we run through some of them in that article. But, it's a highly fraught process when you replace, the market transaction, willing buyer meets willing seller, with, government bureaucrats trying to come up with formulas to figure out what things ought to cost. And as I said, I don't know whether the prices they set are going to be too low and cause the problems associated with that, or too high and cause the problems associated with that. I just know that they're going to be wrong, because the mechanism having government set prices is not a mechanism that can discover what the real price is, which is where a willing buyer would meet a willing seller.
Yeah. Do you see any... what's kind of on the horizon for this, or where are we headed to sort of fix some of that? Do you have to repeal the whole inflation reduction thing, or is this one of those things where we can...
Well, good question. I think obviously a legislative fix would be the best, and we could get rid of this, and we could adopt the rest of the the president's proposals on drugs, or if let's go crazy, the rest of fixing the rest of healthcare would be nice too. And we've got a lot of ideas, and Congress doesn't pass them, and it's been a crazy couple of decades on healthcare, because everything the Democrats do makes everything worse, and then Republicans come in, they don't do anything on healthcare. They have all the right talking points, and they say all the right things. They say, oh, we're going to move towards the market with prices and competition, transparency and choice, and you're going to control the dollars, and there's going to be lots of providers. And then when the Democrats are done attacking them on health care, they say, oh, great, we don't have to talk about health care anymore. Let's switch to another issue. And then they don't pass anything. I mean, I don't know. We had we had this whole Democrat shut down the government for 6 or 7 weeks last year over, you need to extend COVID-era supersized Obamacare subsidies. And Republicans, for once, didn't cave, and they didn't extend them, and the subsidy amount for Obamacare went from 95% to 83% or something like that, and none of the things they said would happen, the parade of horribles they predicted would occur, none of that happened. And then they just say, oh, okay, good, we'll shut down the next one about ICE, or we'll just
have
a different issue. And Republicans, who had introduced some really good bills sort of when they were playing defense, they didn't see any need to actually pass them, to actually go on offense and deliver something for the American people. And so I would love for them to do a health care bill, which, among other things, could include revisiting these price controls. I mean, they didn't even, one of the most insane aspects, I don't even think we got into this in that article, but one of the most insane aspects of these price controls is there's actually a more stringent price control regime. Price controls can hit 4 years earlier for what are called small molecule drugs, basically pills and capsules and tablets, than for biotech drugs, which are mostly injections. So in other words, they're going to punish you for developing a drug in a form that most people would prefer, and reward you for developing a drug in a form that most people would not prefer, which is when you get a stick with a needle. And yet, you know, that was written into the Inflation Reduction Act.
So wait, so how is that? Do that again. Say that part again. Okay, so how is it punishing them to not?
The price control regime can apply to small molecule drugs 4 years earlier. So when a drug is developed, a brand new drug can't be subject to this regime. It gets, you know, several years before it can be subject to this regime. I think it's 8 years and 12. I might have those. I know it's a 4 year difference. It might be 7 and 11. I think it's 8 and 12. But the idea is, there's some number of years before you can be put on the list and the government's going to set your price. But that number of years before the government can set the price and you can be put on this list, it's 4 years longer for biotech drugs, mostly injection drugs, than it is for small molecule drugs like pills and tablets and capsules. As far as I can tell, that's because their lobbyists weren't as good. I mean, I don't know any other reason why
that's terrible.
You would have this differential, right? And there's no, like, policy logic to it. But, you know, if you're developing a drug, you now have 4 years more that you don't have to worry about, you know, the government setting your price if you do a biotech drug. So investment is a lot of investments moving in that direction, as you would expect. And, you know,
yeah, that is interesting because we're all seeing that, right, with these singing, dancing commercials.
Here's the thing. I would like to fix it in the direction of making the price controls less stringent, so move it all to the 12 years. But even if you love price controls, you should at least want to equalize it, right? There's no reason you want one type of drug to be subject to a price control sooner than a different type of drug based on, you know, the size of the molecule. So that's, like, really crazy. But that's an example of something you couldn't fix unless you did legislation, because that was written in the Inflation Reduction Act. So there are a lot of things you can't fix without legislation. There are some things you can fix without legislation. And, one of the things I would love to see Administrator Dr. Oz do, because CMS administers this whole program, is get rid of all the Biden personnel that are still there, because there are a lot of them. And they have this mentality that, you know, subjecting as much as possible to government setting the prices and government micromanagement and regulation is the answer and the solution. None of that's going to make things better. And so I would get rid of the carryover Biden personnel. And I would fix a lot of the specifics, like some of the things I mentioned, where they're going to benchmark a drug's price against, you know, the old treatment that it's replacing and is better than, instead of assuming that it's something new and needs to be sort of developing its own price. So, you know, all these cancer drugs, all these remarkable, innovative cancer drugs, they want to benchmark them against chemotherapy agents and say that's what the price should be based on. Well, that's crazy. I mean, we're not going to get new cancer drugs if there's a risk that government's going to set their price based on old, much less effective drugs. And so, you know, there are a lot of details and specifics that I think could be made much less damaging. I'm not going to say that a price control regime can be made benign, but I think it could be much less harmful than it is right now.
And so what's the argument might not be the best word, but what's the argument against doing that? Like what's the holdup?
I think there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia in these agencies. I think that you get the political personnel at the top of CMS that are very focused on fraud, and understandably, and that's good. But it means they're not paying as much attention to some of the other things that are under their purview. And you've got, you know, when you have a bunch of carryover personnel, there's a lot of inertia, and it's hard to change direction. The other problem with this particular program is, you know, President Trump is not 100% doctrinaire, laissez-faire, free market like I am. And he, I think, sort of likes the idea of, I'm going to hardball these drug companies, you know, I can set the price, we're going to control this. And so he has some sympathies towards this, which is, I think, why it hasn't been, sort of defanged more than I would prefer. And so, you know, that's the other challenge that we've got. Now, if you've got the overall context of all the good things that he's doing, then, you know, overall he's probably moving drug policy in the right direction. But I think that the reason they have not sort of cleaned house of all of these Biden personnel and all of these kind of irrational interpretations of things is a combination of, this is a program that the president probably likes a little bit more than he should, and this is just hasn't been a big focus of Dr. Oz. So, but, you know, they've left a lot of people in place.
Yeah, that is never good. So in this, how much of the Inflation Reduction Act was focused on this? Was this just a little sideline, or?
Well, here's the thing that's so amazing. So this was supposedly one of the big pay-fors. This was supposedly, there were two big ways that they were going to raise money to pay for all the green energy giveaways and, you know, all the other spending shenanigans. By the way, I don't know who remembers this or not, but I like to mention and remind everyone that this bill was originally called Build Back Better.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Manchin said he was totally against it, and I would never vote for Build Back Better. This bill is terrible on it. And then they said, Joe, what if we change the name? But we keep the bill the same, but we change the name to say it's inflation reduction, and then, you know, we're fighting inflation. And they say, oh, okay, yeah, I'll vote for it. So, I mean, that's how they got, just think about how insane that is. That's how they got, you know, their supposed conservative Democrat from West Virginia who was totally against it, and then, oh, well, wait, you changed the name? All right, let's do it. You know, there were two main ways that they were supposedly raising the money to pay for all of the spending. And they said, oh, it's not going to increase the deficit. One of the ways they were going to raise all this money was, of course, supersizing the IRS, adding 80,000 more IRS agents that are going to shake down every business and bring in all this money, and that was another disaster. We could do a whole hour on that. But the second way they were going to raise all this money is they were going to cut Medicare spending, and they were going to, in particular, cut Medicare prescription drug spending by hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
Then take that money out of Medicare and use it to pay for all this other unrelated spending. Now, even if that had worked, I think that would have been a very questionable thing to do because, of course, Medicare's finances are going bust in the near future. And so if you could save hundreds of billions, you should keep it in Medicare, not take it out and use it for green energy giveaways and all the rest of the stuff that was in that bill. But that was the concept. That was the mentality. So it's a pretty big part of the bill in the sense that it was supposed to be, you know, one of the big sources of funding to pay for all the spending in the bill. But here's the thing. Medicare drug spending hasn't gone down. It's gone up since the bill passed. It did not do what they said it was going to do. And in fact, it did the opposite, you know, for a variety of reasons, that it was poorly designed and there were no savings to be had. And they ended up messing up the structure of the benefits such that the Part D plans had to raise their premiums through the roof, and then they bailed them out. And so it ended up, there were no savings. So, you know, these changes were supposedly going to pay for this other spending. It ended up all being deficit spending. And, in fact, they increased rather than decreasing what Medicare spends on prescription drugs, which, by the way, that's a pretty neat feat to not lower prices and also at the same time spend more rather than less. And so they not reduce inflation but rather increase it. We haven't seen a reduction until Trump came in, and so they basically managed to fail in every single possible direction all at the same time.
It's just ridiculous because we do have things on the market that would probably be better than the, you know, host of you know, old things, the pills that are all stacked one on top of the other. They invent something great. Problem is, people can't afford it. You know.
Well, you know, the thing about drugs, this is the thing that's so amazing about drugs. They're way too expensive, and until the patent expires, then they're super, super cheap. Now, that makes them unlike basically anything else, certainly in healthcare, and you know, very few things anywhere in the economy. And so, you know, to me, the most important aspect of drug policy is getting the incentives right to develop new drugs and bring them to market, the clinical trials, spending all the money to get the exam. And by the way, we should reduce what they cost to develop new drugs and bring them to market. A lot of that is FDA regulations, and there are only a handful of companies that really even know how to get things through the FDA process, and smaller companies either get acquired by them or are forced to partner with them, and it's just become a total corrupt regulatory capture kind of thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for reform there, but you know, if your policy is just we're going to strong arm prices down through, you know, government force, essentially, you're going to cause shortages. You're going to cause shortages like any government price control would. And so what you really want to do is get the incentives right. And you know, if you get the incentives right, eventually the price of everything is going to come down dramatically because you eventually reach that, you reach that generic point and the price plunges. And so we've actually designed a pretty good drug pricing system. The challenge, I think, and the problem is the regulatory costs for developing those drugs are too high, and that free rider problem that I mentioned. You know, if the other rich countries were paying in the way we do, we'd get twice as many drugs. and we'd get them at a lower price, and the pace of innovation would be much, much greater.
Who's preventing that? Or, you know, where's the pushback on that?
They don't want to pay. I mean, Europeans don't want to pay. Japanese don't want to pay. The UK doesn't want to pay, although they've been forced to through trade negotiations. But, I mean, it's been one of these things for, you know, basically every president until President Trump knew it was a problem, but they just, I can't do anything about it. There's no way to convince the country to pay more for drugs. And by the way, in Trump's first term, he got Canada and Mexico to agree to pay more for drugs in USMCA, and Nancy Pelosi made him take it out. Made him take it out of the agreement. And I remember this because she only demanded like a handful of changes, and that was one of them. And it was like,
whose team are you on?
What constituency was she fighting for? Trying to get Canada and Mexico to pay less for U.S. drugs. This is bizarre.
Yeah,
but he almost got it done then, and of course now he has got it done in the U.K. trade deal. But that, I think, needs to be the template because, you know, if we could spread these costs out on the other rich countries, we could get, we could get much better value and get a lot more new drugs.
Well, and everybody would win in that regard. It isn't like we're doing it on the back of, you know, the backs of other people.
The whole world would win. Yeah. The whole world would win. And so, you know, that's, I think, a very important part of the president's drug agenda. The other thing that I think
hold that thought,
is really beneficial.
We have to do one more quick break before the top of the hour. And we're going to come right back. Our guest is Phil Kirpin. He is with American Commitment. They engage in critical public policy fights over the size and intrusiveness of government. And there's more after that, but that's
probably a lot.
That's like my favorite part right there.
Yeah.
So that is why he is so passionate about this, and we love having him on. You can find everything about it at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Who's to say I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with them.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Fire and Destruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Explore, learn, and play this summer at Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Discover 300 acres of adventure featuring the Turtle Bay Museum, playgrounds, animals, botanical gardens, trails, and so much more. This summer, experience Popnology and explore science and technology. Marvel at hundreds of butterflies in our butterfly house. Feed lorikeets in Parrot Playhouse. Hop on a ride with the Turtle Express train. And don't miss the popular Walk on the Wild Side Animal Show. Plan your visit today at turtlebay.org.
Gold Leaf Nursery is open and has been serving Shasta County growers since 1975 and going strong. Have you noticed all the different colors of crepe myrtles blooming? We have several varieties and colors. Dwarf size, semi-dwarf, up to full size to choose from. And right now, they're on sale and drought tolerant. It's a great time to buy. Gold Leaf Nursery carries a large selection of water-wise shrubs and trees. Our summer sale is on now. 20% off all gallon and 15-gallon shrubs and trees. 25% off all 25-gallon trees. Need fast-growing trees, 3 to 4 feet per year, drought-tolerant? We have Polyanthemos Silver Dollar and Weeping Willows. Great for screening or fast shade. Don't miss the 20% off sale going on all summer long. Come check out Gold Leaf Nursery on Churn Creek Road, 1/4 mile from Airport Road in Dersh, across from Club Tucker Golf Course.
things aren't always what they seem. So, Bill, you had a thought you wanted to complete, and then Bill's got a question about patents, et cetera.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing that I think is so important that the president's trying to do is cut through this whole PBM debate with direct-to-consumer sales. And, you know, I think we've all seen like a million of these TV ads about the PBMs are bad or they're good. And they
no, what's
like
PBMs? What are PBMs?
Pharmacy benefit managers, they've all been bought by the insurance companies now, but they're essentially the entities that manage the pharmacy benefits for insurance plans, and they, in theory, they negotiate the prices with the pharmacies to get better prices, but in practice, they frequently negotiate for higher prices rather than lower, and large rebates that they can pocket and don't have to use to calculate the copayment at the pharmacy counter, and so they've sort of found a loophole in the federal anti-kickback statute that lets them, you know, essentially in any other government program besides Medicare, you could not say, hey, give me a high price and a high rebate, and I'm going to pocket the rebate, but I'm going to use the high price to set the copay. That would be considered a kickback. It would be if they have an exemption. And the president tried to end that exemption in his first term, and it was a whole huge lobbying fight, and that's probably why he saw a million ads, and he wasn't able to get that done. And this time around, he's kind of doing something I think is very clever, very, very inventive, is he's saying, okay, I'm not going to necessarily do that frontal attack on those guys again like I did last time. They say that they use their negotiating power to lower prices, and it's wonderful for people and so on and so forth. Let's put it to a market test. Let's have direct-to-consumer sales. Let's sell through TrumpRx. Let's get the pharmaceutical companies to sell direct-to-consumer themselves. Let's get companies to sell through Mark Cuban's site. Let's have all these other cash distribution channels and direct distribution channels. And then we'll see, right? If the pharmacies and the pharmacy managers and the insurance companies can deliver better prices through retail pharmacy channels, great, go with them. If you can get a better price through a direct sale, go with that. And, you know, I think if you have that competition, you don't need to have this lobbying contest. You can just, people can have options and choice and competition, and they're going to get better prices, you know, whichever way they're going through, most likely if they do a little searching.
Yeah, when there's competition, that typically always benefits the consumer. I have a question. When a company develops a drug, they patent it. How long do those patents last before those drugs can go generic as a rule?
Well, the patents, pharmaceutical patents are 20 years, but they typically will file the patent when they discover the compound, and then there's a lot more regulatory work and, you know, clinical trials and all of that that goes on. So typically, by the time you get to market, half your patent life is gone, and that's why, you know, they usually push so hard to make as much money as possible in a relatively short window. And so the answer is the patents are 20 years, but the actual period of time where you've got a drug on the market before the patent expires is always going to be less than that.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense.
Well, and this is, so when it comes to Medicare, how much of the, I've never really thought about it, but as we're talking about this, that's got to be a huge percentage of the pharmaceutical market.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how much, but it's big.
It's got to be massive. So that's why they're always after that, and yet it always seems like it's because they're trying to benefit seniors. But it sounds like from everything they, quote, negotiated, it actually didn't. Is that? And a lot of things are based off the Medicare reimbursement as well.
Right. I mean, this is the challenge. You know, okay, when you have a large government system that's doing a lot of the purchasing, how do you still have a meaningful price mechanism? How do you actually discover what things should cost? And, you know, the way that we've done that, the original Medicare prescription drug benefit that was a Republican bill when it was written, the way that they did that is they had this non-interference provision, and they essentially said that the average sales price, I mean, they had a few different formulas, but they essentially said that what Medicare pays would be based on non-Medicare sales, and there would still be enough of a market mechanism to figure out what things should cost. And then they've got the individual plans, the individual Part D plans, they did a lot of negotiation. And so that was kind of the concept and how it was developed. The criticism that you always got from the Democrats, they said, well, no, the Secretary would have the negotiating power to push prices down, and it would be better if they did the negotiations. And, you know, if the negotiations were sort of honest negotiations where you could actually say no to them, there might be some truth to that. But where you have the, you know, the 95% tax and the government's basically setting the price, you've basically destroyed any kind of market mechanism, and now you're just having a bureaucrat decide what things should cost. And as I said, they're either going to set it too high or too low, and there's going to be a lot of problems either way. And that's why you really have to figure out how to design a system where you have, you know, some market mechanism to discover price. And, you know, the original version was not perfect, but it was better than the direction we're moving now.
So who are the allies? How about that? We kind of know who the enemies are, but who are the allies that we have on things like this?
Well, you know, it's a tough question, right? Because the drug companies are mostly right when they fight price controls, but they're wrong about a lot of other things. So I don't want to say they're allies necessarily. You know, I think it's we've got a lot of sort of, you know, Milton Friedman has lots of great quotes on this. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, I tend to look more at the ideological allies, the people who are, you know, trying to get market mechanisms for the right reasons rather than, you know, for self-interested reasons, and they're going to be inconsistent on a bunch of other things. So, I mean, I look to a lot of the other conservative groups that we've worked with, groups like, you know, Americans for Tax Reform and American Conservative Union and Institute for Liberty and Competitive Enterprise Institute, and, you know, those are the groups that have really been, you know, trying to, Cato Institute, although, you know, Cato, you know, because they're so libertarian, they basically say the drug company should just refuse to sell to Medicare and then they wouldn't have these problems, which is probably not a practical solution.
Yeah, that would be bad.
So, look, so it's, you know, I think the strong allies we have, the good allies we have, are usually the, you know, the conservative groups that I work with all the time, I would say. And, you know, most of the Republican elected officials also have good instincts on this stuff. They just, you know, they're like allergic to health care in general. They want to talk about any other issue and change the subject as soon as they can. So that's the bigger problem we have.
Wow. And so going forward, if this is allowed to continue, what do you think the trajectory is?
We've got two different trajectories going on, right? We've got all these Trump policies that I talked about in terms of trying to get trade deals and get other countries to pay more towards U.S. brand drugs, which would be, you know, hugely beneficial. We've got the Trump direct-to-consumer sales stuff. We've got a lot of policies that I think are very helpful, but then we've got these sort of Biden carryover policies of government price setting that I think are pretty destructive. And so, you know, I don't know which way we're headed. I'm trying to affect it, though.
you did what?
I said I'm trying to steer it a little bit to the extent I have any influence.
Well, so what can, you know, I'm thinking about people that are just, well, they're already planning to listen to the archive because they're like, wait, I have to hear that whole thing again. So when they do that and they're thinking, well, what, you know, is there anything people can do to be useful on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been some comment periods. There's not one open right now, but I would say, you know, I would say talk to your congressman. Say, you know, we want competition and choice and not price controls. And it would be nice to do a health care bill this year. I know you're not doing a lot of legislating, but, boy, you've got so many good ideas, and you talk about them, but you don't deliver. So that would be my messages.
Yeah. If you were going to peel back some of the stuff that was in, I mean, the Obamacare thing, I guess, just for most people, the first thing that happened, and we knew it was going to happen, was we disincentivized the medical, you know, going into the medical profession, just as far as GPs and primary care. So I think everybody is really struggling with that. I hear from veterans all the time, you know, it's really hard to get a primary care provider. I'm like, I'd like to say that's not happening in the private sector, but it absolutely is. It's across the board. We kind of blew up our medical system with that. And now, you know, the drug, it looks like the drug thing has been, this explains a lot of what we're seeing actually out here as consumers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, Obamacare by design led to mass consolidation in our healthcare system. We went from about 20% of doctors having a corporate employer to over 60%. And I think it's been very negative for patients that everything's becoming part of these giant health systems and everything self-refers inside of them, and there's just much less competition and choice. And, you know, this is the mentality, I think, of a lot of Democrats and big government advocates. They think, oh, well, they think of competition as, like, redundancy, duplication, waste, instead of seeing that it needs choice and better service and better quality and lower price. And that's why things have moved so badly, I think. And so, yeah, I mean, I would love to see us move the other direction on healthcare more broadly and reverse the consolidation trends. I mean, you know, for hospital services, sorry, for doctor services, Medicare will pay more if your doctor gets bought by a health system and they rebrand the same office building as a satellite location of the hospital. Medicare pays more for the same office visit to the same doctor where he does the same thing as he did before that happened. So what do you expect?
Consolidation. Yeah. And they can't, you know, I mean, I had a niece. She would probably have gone on to medical school, but she wound up being a PA because she didn't think she could cover the cost of medical school if she tried to go into private practice. It just doesn't pencil.
Well, what happens now is instead of what it used to be, which is, you know, where you go to medical school and what are you going to hang your shingle and what are you specialize in,
right.
Now it's
right.
Health systems in the joint. Now they don't even as much think about being independent, running their own practice for the most part. So that's another terrible trend. But yeah, I don't know. We've got, you know, Republicans have talked about all the problems and all the things they're going to do, but they haven't delivered. That's why I keep saying, do a health care bill this year. Don't just talk about it.
And so when your organization, you know, leans into that, what are you told? Can't get 60 votes in
We're
the Senate?
We're told they don't think
that's
50
the
votes
usual.
In the Senate to do anything good. Yeah, even if we did the reconciliation, they don't think they have 50 votes. That's the sad thing. It's not the filibuster. They don't even have 50. So I don't know. It's irritating, but I don't know. It is what it is.
It is irritating because things like this are just going to magnify. So what do you hear from the drug companies? Are they happy with this? It seems like, I mean, we kind of glossed over that part. Sounds like they're making out, but before we walk away from that, is that true, or are they just trying to...
Well, I mean, some of them are. Look, I mean, I think they're somewhat concerned about the idea of, you know, government price setting. Of course, they have huge lobbying influence, so they've been... You know, I think they don't like a lot of the details and a lot of the specifics, but they mostly are, you know, they'll play ball with whoever's in there, basically. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how reliable they are as allies. But, I mean, number one, they want to have the incentives, right, to be in the business they're in, and so I do think they're mostly pretty good on these policy issues, even if, you know, we don't trust them for other reasons.
But we need them. We have a negotiated, what is it, mutually assured destruction, I think is where we are. So, you know, we never have time to do this, but plug American Commitment. We have like a whole minute, like and a half. Give us the American Commitment commercial.
Yeah. We're a national free market advocacy group. We work on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to focus on the issues at any given point in time where citizens being a little more educated and engaged might make the difference. We might be able to actually get something changed, move something bad off the table or something good onto the table. We do a lot of mass comment campaigns, click to comment stuff into regulatory agencies. We do a lot of letters to Congress, and all our stuff is on AmericanCommitment.org if people want to check it out. And then the other thing I'll mention is I've been doing a healthcare project with Stephen Moore and Steve Forbes and Thomas Phillipson. And we've got a whole agenda and a checklist and proposed legislation, all kinds of details we've been pushing up on the Hill. And if people want to see that stuff, it's on mostfavoredpatient.org.
Most favored. Say that
patient.
One more time.
Most favored patient.
Okay. All right, I will add that to our page because, yeah, when you go to your site, it's all about take action. So I really do hope people go there. It's AmericanCommitment.org, and it's well done, and there are a lot of different things that you can plug into, which I think is really what people are looking for. How do I not just get buried in the bad news? We appreciate your taking the time today.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Phil Kirpin with American Commitment. Thanks a million. We're going to have Robert do his magic with the show, and we will post all of that for you at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball. KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.